Hello, my friends, and welcome to another episode of the Scott McKenna Podcast. Thanks, as always, for being here. I'm really excited about this episode, and I think you're really going to enjoy it. This was an awesome conversation and a little bit of a different podcast than normal. My good friend Tyler Harrington of a company called The Harringtons are a husband and wife wedding filmmaking team, also commercial filmmakers. He also has his own podcast. So what we figured is instead of just doing our own podcast and interviewing each other on it, we figured we'd do kind of a combined podcast where we would just have a long conversation. He asks me a few questions, I ask him some questions, and then we just talk about a lot of different things. And I think it'll be really valuable to you. We talk about a lot of different topics. We talk about everything from the wedding film industry to working as a husband and wife team. We talk about podcasting. We talk about personal branding. We talk about, does it make sense to have a business name separate if you do weddings versus commercial? Should you have different brands? Should you go with your own name rather than a company name? So many different things, as you can tell, were discussed. I think you're going to love this one. And because it's long, I'm going to try to jump right into it so that you can get right into the episode. So thanks for listening. As always, connect with me on Twitter at Scott W. McKenna, and we'll catch up right after this episode. Let's jump right in. Thanks for being here. So first of all, I'd love to hear a little bit. I know we have very similar backgrounds, which is pretty cool. And I'd love to kind of hear how you guys kind of got started in general with this whole journey of, I think like me, you guys do weddings, but you also do some other type of work. But how did you kind of get into this from the start?
Yeah, that's a great question. So yeah, we mostly do weddings. That's kind of like our bread and butter. But over the last couple of years, we've gotten into doing a lot more of, you know, some like commercial work, quote unquote, commercial work. But we work mostly with, you know, creative small business owners and things like that. So the way I got into it, honestly, was I was in college, kind of like a lot of people. I started taking photography classes all the way back, you know, when I was in high school, and I did, you know, the whole film, black and white photography thing. And I was always kind of known as a photographer, you know, quote unquote. And I always had a camera with me and things like that. And it was, you know, when I was in college, kind of like a lot of people, I feel like getting started in weddings, you know, I had a friend who couldn't afford to pay a professional photographer. He knew I had a nice camera. So he asked me if I'd be willing to, you know, take photos at his wedding. Of course, I said, sure, why not? You know, $250, that sounds great. That's, you know, more money than I've seen in a month in college. So I, you know, agreed to do that. And it was just a really perfect timing for me because I, you know, ran in a lot of Christian circles. So a lot of my friends were getting engaged and getting married kind of like as they're graduating and things like that. And I was super involved with a Christian organization on campus. So I had a lot of friends who were older than me, a lot of friends who are younger than me. So I was kind of in this like perfect sweet spot of, you know, I was at the time, I think I was maybe a junior. So I was 3 years into my 5 year college career. And, you know, just a lot of my friends were getting married and engaged and, you know, didn't want to necessarily pay for like a professional. So I just kind of started from there. People saw the photos. I did a ton of research and just spent a ton of time like learning and watching a million YouTube videos and doing everything I could to figure out how to shoot that wedding as well as I possibly could. I invested in some gear. Like I kind of did all the things that I didn't even really know I was supposed to do, but like looking back now, it was kind of just like the perfect storm.
Yeah.
So I ended up with some pretty good photos from that, you know, all things considered. And it kind of just spiraled from there. And then the way I actually got into video was a little bit, you know, kind of a funny story. I had a friend, same kind of deal, who knew that I knew how to set up the sound system from our Christian organization, and she was like, hey, can you bring the sound system to my wedding and basically like run a playlist off of it, right? And you can DJ the wedding, since she knew I knew how to set up the sound system. So I said, you know, sure, whatever. But because of that, I had to go to the rehearsal dinner. So at the rehearsal dinner, I had just gotten a brand spanking new Canon 60D, that shot video.
Yeah.
So I whipped that puppy out and I was just kind of messing around and I started shooting some video clips and just, you know, the fact that I could rack focus was amazing. You know, this was, you know, revolutionary to me. So I kind of just like messed around with it, took it home, threw it into iMovie, put some explosions in the sky behind it, and threw that thing up on Facebook. And I remember the next day at the wedding, one of my friends came up to me who had seen this little, you know, thing that I had made and was like, dude, that video you made was great. You could probably charge people like $1,000 or something like that.
And you're like, $1,000?
Oh my goodness. I was like, $1,000? I was like, man, that's a great idea. So I was already starting to invest in photo gear and I kind of started doing this video thing. And then a friend from back home, her mom saw this film that I had made on Facebook and was like, hey, my daughter's getting married next summer. So like 8 months from now, could you do video for that wedding? So I was like, sure, I can figure it out between now and then. So that was when I really started diving into video and I started watching tons of like still motion tutorials and just learning everything I could about video. And I started investing in, you know, like a monopod and, you know, got my Rode VideoMic Pro, like all those kind of like basic things you get when you're first starting. And since I was already starting to shoot photos, I had, you know, by that time I'd purchased a 5D Mark III and I had a few lenses and things like that. So I did that first video wedding. And again, I just kind of like poured my heart and soul into learning everything I could about video. I went to that wedding and again did a pretty good job, all things considered. You know, looking back at it now, it was a kind of a good starting, like launching piece to have. And then from there, everything just kind of just kept growing and kind of taking off. You know, then we were doing half video, half photo, just from that point forward, just kind of whatever was coming, photo, video, whatever, just kind of started taking that. And then when my wife and I got married in 2013, which was, you know, probably, I don't know, a year and a half after this whole thing had kind of started, it just sort of made sense for her to jump in, because she had a little bit of a background in photo. Not really. It definitely wasn't like her strength, but she had a camera. She knew how to use it, mm-hmm. but she was really good at, you know, the connection part. She was really good at like speaking the bride's language. I was trying to blog weddings like a girl photographer would, and it just wasn't really working out. You know, I was like trying to talk about the shoes and the dress and the whatever, and it just wasn't very genuine. It just didn't come across quite right. But she could come in, and that was very natural for her. Yep. And she, you know, we had just had our own wedding, so she was kind of in that world. The whole thing just kind of started, you know, kind of worked out from there. And then it just kind of kept growing and growing and growing, bigger and bigger and bigger. And it got to a point where we're like, all right, we need to go full time with this in order to really, you know, be able to keep up with the demand or, you know, whatever. It just kind of just kept growing from that point forward.
Yeah, I mean, it's amazing the resources that we have now at our fingertips to learn. I think it's when I started, I started this company in 2012 or 13, but video way before that. And when I first started, it was obviously YouTube wasn't quite like it is now, where just the amount of resources that we have available to be able to learn is just incredible.
Oh yeah.
And I think it's so cool that so many people, you know, you and I are some of the people that also do it, but just how many people are willing to share, you know, what they're learning is just awesome, because it's a cool thing that you can learn anything online now, which is so neat.
No, 100%. That was half the reason I wanted to start this podcast, because it gave me an excuse for something to go and research and to dive deep into that I hadn't been able to do in a while. You know, because I kind of found a comfort zone of video stuff, and you kind of get to a point, you know, there's obviously ups and downs. You never learned everything, but you get to a point where you're like, all right, I feel like kind of comfortable with my knowledge, and I feel like I'm kind of, even as you're educating and stuff like that, but to dive into something I didn't know anything about, you know, this whole audio world, the podcasting world, all that stuff, for me was a really great like challenge, and it's something I really enjoy. So I kind of do that with everything I do, whether that's a tech product I'm going to buy, whether that's, you know, the podcast, whether that's a new editing technique or whatever it may be. That's something I really love doing. And I know that you're like that too. And you have a very similar background to me when it comes, like you said, researching things and diving deep into things. Where do you think that started for you? Is that something you've always kind of seen in yourself?
I mean, I think similar to a lot of people that get into video, usually you start getting into video or even photography because you're trying to capture something that you're already doing. So I was a full-time musician for 10 years before I ever started this company. So naturally, I was always filming stuff all the time, regardless, for my own benefit. It was recording stuff of me performing and me traveling and doing different things. Obviously, YouTube didn't really exist then as much, so I didn't really publish any of that stuff, nor do I even know where the footage is anymore. But I kind of got into it just simply by wanting to just film what I was doing naturally. And then as I started to get more into it, and then realized I was kind of getting tired of music in terms of actually touring and all that kind of stuff, I realized that there was obviously a big need. I think video is obviously super powerful. So I naturally got into that. And then I went on staff at a church, and that was one of the primary things I did. So just kind of learned more and more and just absorbed every piece of valuable content I found to learn. And by no means do I ever think that I'm ever a master. So I'm always trying to just get better in everything I do. But I really do, I try as hard as I can to really compare my work to my past work rather than just the best cinematographer in the entire world, because I'm not there yet. So I'm not looking at other people's film and saying, is it as good as theirs? Is it as good as this? Is it as good as that? I'm literally looking at my last film and trying to make the next film I do better than that one.
No, yeah, for sure. And it can be really discouraging, and it's both good and bad. I think like the exposure that we have to all these amazing filmmakers and all the amazing films that are out there, it is really great to see those things and be inspired by them and to kind of like glean some ideas from them and to learn from them. But at the same time, you're right, the comparison can be a really big thief of your joy if you're always comparing your work to their work. And you know, it's never an apples to apples comparison. There's always different factors that go into it, and I think that's great, like, you know, always looking at your past work and see how you've grown. Because I know that's been our goal, is to continue to grow from year to year to year to year, is just continue to improve our films to make them look better and better and better. And it's kind of discouraging and encouraging to look back even at films from a year ago and look at those and say like, gosh, what was I doing? What was I thinking? You know, but I mean, so, which is like, you know, kind of, you wish that your work then was the same that it is now, but at the same time, that's good because that means that you're growing and you're continuing to learn.
Yeah, it'd be more frustrating if you looked back a year ago and you're like, nothing's changed.
Right.
Because then you're like, well, I wasn't great then, so there's no way that it should still be identical to what it was at that point. Yeah, it's just, and yeah, for sure, you should absolutely look at people that are doing things really well and see lighting or see certain techniques and say, that's really something I should learn and get better at. But it's straight up comparing yourself to their work can hurt you because it doesn't necessarily help you get better if you're only letting it discourage you rather than if I see an incredible filmmaker, I'm going to be inspired by it and want to learn from it. But I'm not going to be discouraged by that their work is currently better than mine because that's we're at everyone's at different levels.
And I think that there's actually a strategy to watching other people's films, to learning from them. Mm-hmm. I think that if you're just watching them and you're just like, I don't know, just watching it through and just comparing like the quality or the shots or like how pretty the scenery is or whatever, that I think it can be kind of discouraging. But the way I like to watch films to learn from them is I watch it once through just to kind of enjoy it as a viewer would enjoy it and get the emotion from it and kind of just get the feel for it. But then I'll go back and I'll watch it again and again and again. And I'm paying attention to, okay, what do I like this shot? What's my favorite shot? Okay, why do I like this shot? What type of lens is it? Is it a wide angle lens? Is it a telephoto lens? Is there camera movement? Is the camera static? Is it high? Is it low? Mm-hmm. Where's the light? Where's the light coming from? What is the light doing? You know, what makes this shot really good? And if you can start to really start breaking things down like that, instead of just looking at something and be like, oh my gosh, that's amazing. I want my films to look like that. And then just going out and not really thinking through the actual process of like, okay, well, how did they actually get this shot?
Yep.
What is the actual process went behind it? You can start looking at films in that way and start breaking them down and analyzing them almost. And like I said, I'll watch the same film over and over and over and over again sometimes just to kind of figure out, okay, what exactly is happening here? And then that way, when you go to not replicate it, but you go to shoot your wedding, okay, I really like the shots that are shot with this type of an angle or this type of a lens or this type of a camera movement, then you have something you can actually go out and try and do and try and replicate, as opposed to just saying like, oh my gosh, it's so amazing, I'll never know how I'm going
to
get there.
Yeah. And how do you feel like a lot of people like to ask like, what's the difference between commercial work and wedding work and all that kind of stuff? And I've always said that doing weddings now for a couple of years and being, you know, the most high stress, high pressure type of job you can find, when you go to shoot a commercial job, small business, whatever it is, are you like me where you feel like, I don't like using the word easy because it's not easy to do anything. I feel like commercial work is just so relaxed and I can set things up how I want. I can redo takes. It seems so much, I don't like the word easier, but easier.
Yeah, I would say that it's definitely different. And I actually think because I've been doing weddings for so long and that's sort of my sweet spot, that doing the commercial stuff actually, even though it is less stressful from like a time standpoint and it's just a little bit different in that element, it's definitely a different side of my brain that's working and I feel much less comfortable in that environment, mostly because, like I said, I'm used to the weddings, but used to not having to deal with setting things up and just capturing as it's happening, or, you know, I've gotten good at that.
Right.
But when I actually, okay, now I've like, okay, I have the ability to control this and I have the ability to set it up how I want, that's a whole other set of decisions I need to make. And again, it's just different. You know, it's different in all the different areas. Sometimes for me, I actually find it a little bit harder or more stressful because now I'm like, oh my gosh, if something goes wrong or I don't set this up well, or I don't do this well, that's all on me. I can't blame it on, it's not my fault. It's like, it's a wedding, or I did the best I could with the situation or whatever. It's like, no, I had control over all of it.
Yeah.
It's all on me. So I think it kind of goes both ways. I think it kind of ebbs and flows. But yeah, the best way I can describe it is just,
it is. It's very different. And it's different when you get control, like you said. Yeah. Not being able to blame something on somebody else is definitely a big factor. I just feel like, I guess it's really the stress. It's not as much the easy versus hard type of filming as much as it's just being able to control things I love, because I can really say, let's look at this in a camera. Not great. Let's move you to some better lighting. Let's try this. That's really the part that feels like, this is amazing. I can set it up exactly how I want it to look.
And I think my problem is like, I don't ever take those opportunities as much as I should sometimes. I'm like, well, this is like, we'll just, you know, because I'm just like, we'll just make it happen like as we are. But instead of thinking, okay, wait, stop. We need to like take the time. As soon as I feel like I'm moving too slow, or like, I'm going to miss something else, or like, we're wasting time, or whatever.
You're used to being on a time crunch.
Yeah, I'm used to just, you know, getting it as it goes. I'm like, we got it on the first try. Like, let's keep moving.
Yeah.
So it's definitely, but it's good. I like the challenge, and I like being forced to kind of think that way. And yeah, it's a different way of thinking, but I do enjoy that. And I know that you're getting a lot more into like commercial stuff, into real estate and those types of things. So like, how is that sort of jump been from, you know, doing weddings and the real estate world, which is like completely different, almost the opposite. Yeah. Like you said, like literally nothing is moving. It's all staged. It's all set up. Like, how has that transition been? And how have you found that from like a creative standpoint? Do you feel like that gives you just a relief from creativity? Is it something you enjoy?
So I look at it from a couple of different angles. From a business side of it, I look at it in terms of it's not my goal to just do wedding films for my entire life. I know that obviously there's only so long that I can physically shoot them. And so I'm getting to a point where I naturally am trying to make a transition over the next couple of years to me not really shooting all the weddings, first off. And then more importantly, just being able to decide, okay, well, when I don't shoot weddings anymore, or when my company's only focus is not weddings, what are the different things that we actually want to do? So I've been spending a lot of time over the last year, really the last year since I've been full time, deciding like what is the next avenue of what we want to do, and starting to take on a lot of different work, like you said, real estate, commercial work, aerial work, to really get a feel for like, what do I actually enjoy doing? What do I want to shoot next? I do feel like you can scale anything and build people up and train people to be able to shoot weddings, commercial work, whatever. And so I'm just really trying to figure out from a company standpoint, what makes sense? How can I continue to grow my business? I only want to take on 25 to 30 weddings a year regardless, but I know that the only way you can take on that amount of work and make it full time is if you just keep raising prices over and over, which I feel like without question, there's more and more people doing it now. So even talking with some high end cinematographers, it's a different business even at that scale now than it was a couple of years ago. So I just know that it doesn't make sense for, in my opinion, to just do weddings because it's also seasonal. I live in the Northeast, so it's a 6-month window. And then even in that 6-month window, it's really like the same 20 weekends that everyone's getting married. So, and I don't have a separate team that does it. So I'm always just trying to figure out how I can continue to grow. From a creative standpoint, I do think that it's valuable to do other things. I feel like it is really easy to kind of get into here's how I know to shoot bride prep. Here's how I know to shoot a ceremony. I know to shoot this with the couple, this with the couple. And it's easy to get really just template based, where your edits start to look the same, your shots start to look the same. And so doing other things and using different lenses and different lighting and different things, I do think helps because it allows you to think about things differently that maybe you can bring into a wedding film. Even though filming real estate or filming a commercial is so different than a wedding, some principles still apply. And getting an idea of how those can help in the actual other fields that you're doing, I think is valuable.
Yeah, and I always say that if you can shoot weddings, I think you can pretty much shoot anything else because there's so many different skills and so many different things you have to do on a wedding day. And like we talked about, you have to do them the first try,
pretty close quickly.
To the first try. Right, very quickly and very efficiently. So if you can take those skills that you learn in weddings, that's why I think there's a lot of wedding filmmakers who are doing that these days. You see in these wedding filmmaking groups and things like that, that most people, they're in weddings for a little bit. You know, weddings are a great place to kind of get started, learn these skills, build up your gear. And then a lot of filmmakers are kind of moving into the commercial world, into these, you know, different types of projects and stuff like that, just because of what you're talking about, like weddings are really hard to scale, and it's also just like really taxing from like a physical standpoint. Like weddings days are hard, it's, you know, your weekends are completely gone, and it's just like a lot of travel. It's a lifestyle that's kind of hard to maintain, to foreseeably maintain for the next 20, 30 years or whatever.
And especially when you have kids. I mean, I have a 2.5-year-old and I have a 9-month-old. Right now, my weekends are okay. They're free because I can decide my work week. But weekends, once kids get into sports or get into different things, like that's a much bigger, like if you don't have kids, you don't necessarily realize that yet, but it's a big factor of what it looks like when your kids are in school and then weekends are the only time you have free. I don't need to shoot weddings forever, and it's not that I don't love doing it now, but it's more just I know what's realistic, like the taxing, the weekends. It's just not, it's so I do think that it's good for people to do both things. I think that you obviously can definitely make a living doing just weddings.
It's just tough to sustain. I mean, we've got a lot of friends who are moving into that part of their career now, right, where they've been doing weddings for 8, 9, 10 years, and they rode the wave, and they maybe had like kids along the way who, like you said, are getting, now they're older, they're starting to play sports and things like that. And a lot of them are in that stage of life where they're like, hey, what's our next move? Where are we going to pivot to? And I think that if you're going to be an entrepreneur, if you're going to do anything, you know, running your own business, you've got to be able to pivot. Like, you've got to be able to figure out, like, see what's coming next and figure out how you're going to pivot and move into... Yep. into that next era of your life before it's too late. Because if you wait until it's past that point, wait until it's too late, then, you know, you've already missed the opportunity. It's going to be really hard for you to make that transition. But if you can kind of stay ahead of it, kind of like you said, you're doing, start working stuff in. We're still doing that too, you know, working commercial stuff in here and there. It's not our priority, but we're kind of moving more in that direction. I'm also thinking about that when I consider things like gear purchases and things like that. Like, not just how am I going to use this for weddings, but how can I also use this for commercial things if I wanted to move into more of like even the higher end commercial market or whatever. That's a whole different,
and that's different definitely level, so. A big factor, and we'll talk about gear in a little bit obviously, but that is a huge factor that is very different. What is required from a wedding standpoint versus a commercial standpoint can be very, very different, because it really depends on what type of work you're shooting outside of weddings. Some of the stuff that works great for weddings are not ideal for long-term events, things like all these, you know, DSLRs that a lot of people are using now, and then you suddenly have a commercial work that is some long shoot, your same gear doesn't necessarily work that well for those kind of things. I think you and I are both in a situation where the cameras that we do use, UC100s and different those bodies, which are great, no recording limits, all that. I use GH5 stuff, same thing. Those kind of translate over other type of work, which is great. But there are a lot of factors that go into that for sure. But what I'm curious about from your standpoint, I would love to hear your thoughts. Like, so you work with your wife. I that's how I started my business. Now I don't anymore because we have kids and now I have other shooters. But what are kind of some of the challenges? Obviously, there's good things and bad things. I know that it was sometimes hard for my wife and I to separate. Like, when we're working together, if I'm a little more like aggressive and please do this right away, it's not husband wife, it's we're working together, like, try to separate that. How do you guys do with that?
Yeah, no, it's definitely tricky. And I think that people look at it from the outside and like, oh, it must be so great working with your wife. Like, that must be so amazing. And it is, like, it really is amazing. And like, we've had some amazing opportunities and we have a lot of really cool things we can do in our life because of the fact that we work together and all those different things. And the business has grown in ways that never would be able to without her working with me, just because of what she brings to the table. But there's definitely a lot of like kind of like side, like quote unquote, like baggage that kind of comes along with that most people don't see. And that is one of those big things. It can be really muddy and it can be kind of difficult to separate the business side of life and your personal side of life, especially when you're working from home and you're kind of always together. So it's, you know, becomes like, okay, are you frustrated with me because that blog post didn't go up in time, or you're frustrated because I didn't do the dishes, vice versa, right? And they kind of can start to bleed together. Right. And it's hard to, like, you know, sometimes, you know, if you work in an office, you like leave it at the office, or like, oh, I had a rough day with like my coworker, or like, oh, my coworker's getting on my nerves or whatever. You can just go home and kind of like vent to your wife, or you can go home and kind of like leave that at the office and come back the next day and kind of refresh. For us, we don't really have that option. You know, we may have like a frustrating day, or I have a hard day, or it might just be tough or whatever. We don't really have the option of just like walking away from that and like separating it. So, I mean, I think the way that we handle it is it's just taking a long time of a lot of just like a lot of conversation, a lot of, you know, communicating, doing the best we can to state like, okay, like this is a business thing, this is a personal thing, trying to be able to read those signs. But it's hard because like I've watched some of your behind the scenes stuff where you're working, you know, a full wedding day and you're talking to your second shooter and things like that. And it's just like, it's just a different level of the way that you communicate with them, and 100%. Just like their understanding, and just that relationship is just so different.
Yep.
And sometimes I'm like, oh, it would be so much easier, like quote unquote, to have that. But at the same time, there's also a lot of perks to working with your spouse.
Expense.
Where you know that there's kind of pros and cons to both. But so how would you say, like, because you've done that transition, you've gone from working with your wife to now working with an associate, and Pablo is your full time associate. Is that
I mean, he works essentially full time for me. So he anything we're doing, he's doing something with that. So whether a shooter, and that's for the last probably 9 months or so. That's, I mean, I assume where your question was going was what's been the difference between that, between husband and wife into this new stage?
Yeah. And how did, like, for the Pablo thing, did he start out as a friend of yours who kind of came into this? Has it always been like strictly business? Like, how did he kind of?
Yeah. So he started as just, you know, like one of my best friends. I met Pablo maybe 6 years ago or so when I was on staff at another church and he was a drummer. So we naturally jived really well just because he was kind of had a business mind. He's a lot younger than I am. He's only 24. I'm 33. So he's a rare 24-year-old that he's been kind of in business for a while, like doing his own type of stuff. When we started talking about all this kind of stuff and just talking about video and business and all that, we just got along really well in a lot of conversations. And then he kind of started his own kind of media company a while back with another buddy of his who was kind of the tech guy. And then that didn't necessarily go how he hoped. And so when I was going full time in May, I decided to kind of approach him and say, hey, you know, I would love to bring somebody on board that can do a lot of the same things I can, because I do think that there's a lot of value in obviously having someone that complements you in the other side of things. But with Pablo, a lot of our strengths are the same. Like, we are really good people, really good at selling, really good at getting business. I'm definitely the much more tech savvy guy than Pablo is. But at the same time, I'm not trying to be the only tech person. Like, I'm really trying to train him and train other people so that I don't have to do it all. But I definitely, from my standpoint, really like working with somebody else other than my wife, only because it does make it, it's hard to disconnect. It's really, really hard to disconnect, and it's hard to demand, like, I like to think no matter what that I'm an easy person to work with, but if I say certain things that are very forceful, like, no, I need you to go do this now, my wife doesn't hear that as well as somebody that is working for me.
Right.
And Pablo knows where I'm coming from. Like, he's never offended. I mean, I'm super honest with things about when we critique work, when he critiques my work, his work, we're great with that. My wife, that's a different story in that term. Like, we have a great relationship as it is, but I think that our relationship as a couple would not be nearly as strong if we had to balance that, because it was difficult then. And then when you add kids in, it's just not even possible. But I think that it's a no-brainer that when we were working together, you know, I don't have to pay her, so that's really great. Like, it's lots of pros to it too. I think that the female side of it is huge. I think it is a humongous advantage when you have a female shooter that is with brides. I think that just from a comfortable standpoint, they understand what to talk about. Like, I think that that's great. Literally, my thing I like the least is actually shooting bride prep stuff, just because for the most part, I'm just awkwardly trying to just find the right spots.
Yeah, you're like the only guy in the room awkwardly holding a camera. Yeah, people are like changing interests. So, yeah, it's always tricky to kind of navigate.
Yeah, so I think that there are definitely pros and cons to it without question. And I think it's just a matter of, I think you guys are doing it well. Like, my wife didn't necessarily like the stuff that I know that Ashley does well. That's a huge advantage to you. You have her doing a lot of the stuff that is super helpful to the business. My wife didn't really like that kind of stuff. So it was kind of her only thing that she really did was shoot. And then she'd do some editing for me every once in a while early in the stage. Now she wouldn't do that at all. She would think it's too much pressure. But so that's kind of just, it's different though. I mean,
yeah, no, it's just different. And I think that at some point in our life, we'll probably end up, the nice thing is that we do have the ability to kind of transition into that, once we have kids on the line and things like that. If Ash wanted to kind of phase out or kind of phase away from the business a little bit, and we wanted to bring on another shooter or bring on an associate or whatever, that would definitely be an option. And it would be a much more smooth transition than if, like, a lot of our friends who are, you know, photographers who are women, you know, they're the lead, truly the lead kind of everything. Right. And when they start having kids, it gets a lot more tricky for them, because they're the face of the business. They're like literally, they're everything, right? So for them to kind of step away or have someone come in and shoot, like, that just kind of makes it a lot more complicated than we kind of have it. So we could easily make that transition, which is nice.
That transition is actually into a cool question because I like to hear people's thought on this. The idea of, you know, let's try to maybe provide some value to people listening, that someone's starting a business, whether it's wedding business, whether it's an actual business, the idea of, do you start it as your name versus do you start it as a company name? What are your thoughts? And I'll give mine.
That's a great question. So,
because you just said it transitioned, because you said that, you know, if that person leaves their business and they're the face of the company, their reputation's gone. But there's the opposite side too.
No, that's definitely true. So I think it depends on how you run your business, right? So for us, we try to run it as very personal as possible. Like our personal social media and our business social media, we don't really have business social media. They're all kind of one in the same. So we have our personalities and ourselves intertwined through every aspect of our business, right. Which again, I think there's a lot of pros to that because people feel very comfortable. They feel like they can connect with us in a different way. I feel like we book a lot of clients because they love us right. as people more than they even love our yep. films, right? Which is very like, you know, you can't replicate that. We are our most valuable asset. Yep. But you're right, like down the road, if we ever wanted to expand or bring in different team members or have, you know, a team full of people shooting, that's just not really a possibility. So at that point, we'd have to kind of pivot and pick a different name or whatever. So I think a lot of it is going to come down to kind of like your aspirations for the future, kind of like what you want to see in the future, how you run your business. If you want to run it more as just like as a business entity, kind of separate from who you are and making the brand based around the business and what the business can do and those types of things, then I think using your name doesn't make as much sense if you're not going to be a part of the identity of right. of the brand. But if you, like us, are woven so integrally into it, it kind of makes sense to go that way. But what are your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, that? I think, yeah, there are absolute pros and cons of both. I've kind of gotten the approach that I much prefer to have my company name as not me, and then to just do mm-hmm. as much as I can of all my YouTube content and all my personal brand stuff is me, so that my brand goes with me no matter what, that any company I start, I still have the leverage of my name to say, here's my company, else, you know, outside mm-hmm. of that. But at the same time, that if 2 years from now, I'm not shooting a single wedding or editing a single wedding, but 4LC Studios as a whole is, it allows me to, when I have conversations with couples, to transition of, don't expect it to be me. Expect that you know me as a brand, that I will not send somebody who's not qualified. I will not give you something that's not good. But at the same time, it doesn't build me as needing to be the only person. And that transitions, I think, like you said, a lot of it has to do with how you actually just set up these jobs in the first place. When I used to talk with couples, my huge selling point was like, you get me every single time. You're always, hey, you have that to trust, all this kind of stuff. I don't say that anymore. It still is mm-hmm. me on every single wedding until I decide not to. But because of the fact that I know that I am at a point where in the next year or so I may make transitions, I go much more to the conversation of what to expect when we shoot your wedding, not necessarily me, just because you never know. Like, I don't know what's going to, you know, happen. And if I'm booking a wedding now for late 2019, I don't know if I definitely will be the person shooting, and I don't want to force right, myself. Yeah. So, but that's really a big shift in the way you talk to people. Some people really like to sell like the perk of, you get me on your wedding day, which is great. But then when they ask you, what happens if you're sick? And then you got to suddenly make it seem like, oh, well, it's not a big deal if I'm not there. Like, that's a whole different conversation.
No, that's a great point. Yeah. And that's something that we've, like, knock on wood, never had to encounter. But that is a good point, you know. And that's the hard thing about weddings, is that because you're booking up so early and you're booking so far in the future, that any of those types of big decisions or big transitions or pivots you want to make, you actually have to kind of think about, you know, 12 to maybe sometimes in like 18 yep. months in advance if you want to make like a big pivot. So for us last year, our big pivot was we stopped offering photo. Mm-hmm. You know, like I said, we've been doing half of our weddings every year were photo, half of them were video for about 4 years. And last year we finally decided, okay, we're not going to do photo anymore. We're only going to offer video, which kind of had been a long time coming. But it was one of those things where once we stopped it, it took about 6 to 8 months to kind of like vamp the cycle. Yeah. So we had a really rough off season last year. We went a really long time without booking just because, you know, we took away half of our revenue, half of our income stream, half of our referrals. And it took about, you know, this entire last year to really kind of like rev that back up. And now we're at a point where it's almost like it never happened, but it took, you know, a while for that to kind of chug out. Where in, you know, in a perfect scenario, we would have gone back in time and kind of planned that out a little bit further ahead of time, made the announcement a little sooner, made the, you know, figure that out a little bit further in advance. But yeah, like I said, I don't think there's a right or a wrong way to do it. You know, we were Harrington Weddings. We were like Harrington Photo and Video, and we've come now, we're just the Harringtons. Mm-hmm. So we're, again, not pigeonholing ourselves into just weddings or just photo or video or you know, whatever.
Yeah, there's not a right or wrong way, but yeah, I definitely think it is important, especially if you're doing weddings and you're a person that's kind of new into this business, to always be thinking 12 to 18 months out, because of the fact that you do have to, any wedding I book right now and say I'm going to be there for in late 2019, at the minimum, till late 2019, I have to be at every wedding versus right. just being aware of that. If you're doing commercial work, it's different because if someone just randomly comes and you suddenly change everything, you change all your pricing, you change all that, it's not really that hard to just say, okay, here's what we do from now on. Weddings are different. And so I always just am trying to think about like the future to hope that I put myself in that position. But I do think there's value in, you know, in building you guys are doing, you know, and I heard another podcast that you did. I forget the girl's name, but I think there is value of producing content from your own, the Harrington site, that is also personal, because it just gets people to fall in love with you guys, which ultimately is the best sell anyway, not necessarily just business. But like you said, there's always going to be cons of, well, the Harringtons is no longer Tyler and Ash. Now what?
Right. Yeah. No, exactly. And yeah, it's hard because it is like a really compelling selling point because nobody can replicate us, right? Nobody has our dynamic. Nobody can do what we do. No one can offer the Harrington's experience.
And that's also the downfall.
Right. Which allows us, right, which was our best advantage and also our biggest weakness, in that if that ever goes away, or if, you know, if Ash gets pregnant and she can't shoot weddings anymore or whatever, then that becomes a conversation where, you know, but again, luckily, I mean, Ash's presence on a wedding day is very important. And like I said, even just her being there, more than her shooting or anything like that, like just her presence and her being there is really helpful. And a lot of the stuff that she does in our client experience, you know, behind the scenes with
could
the
still be done.
And just our whole sequence, she could still do a lot of that stuff. And then the shooting part, you know, obviously it's nice having her there, but I think that if push came to shove and we absolutely had to send me and a second shooter, the experience wouldn't be that different. The end product wouldn't be that different.
Yeah, that's a good conversation. No, it's good things for people to think about when they're building a business, no doubt.
So it's, and along the same lines, as far as branding and stuff like that goes, you have both your weddings and your commercial work both under the same studio. Had you ever considered doing a separate wedding studio? It was a little bit more of like a, you know, quote unquote, like feminine kind of like bride to attract brides or vice versa. Had you ever kind of considered that?
I'm currently thinking a lot about it. primarily because it's very hard to figure out like how do you post all your work on Facebook and on Instagram and all that kind of stuff when it goes from a real estate shoot to a wedding to a commercial shoot.
Right.
I thinking about this all the time. I still don't know necessarily the answer. I look at it right now and to an extent, I feel like there's almost some sort of ways to tie in both in the manner that somebody gets married and then they eventually look for homes and they build a relationship with me, they eventually sell. Like there's lots of ways. I do think that there's value of having like a wedding brand and a other brand, but there's more to it than simply tomorrow starting your name, like with all taxes and business stuff and all that. There's lots to it, but I'm heavily into that conversation right now of trying to figure it out because it is hard to brand. I always say that it's important that somebody goes to my website and knows what I do, and I have a landing page that'll say weddings are commercial, but that's still not ultimately the same as you land at 4LCStudios.com and it is clear weddings are our thing or something else is our thing. It is kind of hard in that. What is your take on it?
Yeah. So I mean, right now, like I said, since weddings are our priority, everything we do is primarily like weddings first. And then the commercial stuff is all pretty much just through word of mouth. And since we do work with a lot of small, like creative entrepreneurs who are mostly in the wedding industry or, you know, have connections to the wedding industry, it kind of works out fine for us. We have a commercial tab on our website, but it's not very prominent. It just has, you know, a few videos on there if people want to see them. But they do look a lot like our wedding work and things like that. So it's not so far off. But I think that in the future, if I were to try and make that a bigger part of our business and move in that direction, I think we'd probably either have to make some sort of like an offshoot of it, something to differentiate it, just because, yeah, like what brides are looking for and what commercial clients are looking for are two very different things. And I think that you want to make them both feel very comfortable and both feel like you are an expert in what it is that they want. And that was the same thing. The problem we were running into with video and photo stuff was that we were kind of sending mixed messages, like, are they photographers? Do they do video? Like, if I want them for a photo, is that like, are they better at video than photo or, you know, whatever? So I think there is value to having clarity and kind of niching down. But at the same time, depending on your market and depending on kind of where you're at and what your goals are and financially and stuff like that, you know, there's advantages kind of doing a little bit of everything. So you kind of just got to weigh out your pros and cons.
And I think that that's also why it is valuable to build personal brand, because if you if I tomorrow created a new company name under for real estate or whatever, there's still already some leverage in terms of my name is behind that brand versus if 4LC Studios was the only brand anybody ever knew and never knew a single piece of me being tied to that, and then a brand new name opens up and there's nobody that can really push that brand, you kind of lose that side of it. But yeah, I definitely think that you can't, if you're a company that offers everything, chances are what that really translates to is that you are not really known for anything. If you offer everything, people just don't really know what you actually are good at. People think that there's value in like having this company that we do everything video, everything photo, everything. Well, the problem is when they go to your website, that's what they're going to see. And they're not going to really know what you actually are good at. Like, what are you actually known for? You need to be known for something.
Right. I think of it almost like a restaurant. When I go to a restaurant that has a you know, 12-page menu and they've got a million things on the menu, I know, I'm like, there's no way all of this is good. There may be one good thing on this menu, but like, probably not. But you go to a restaurant where they have, you know, six main menu items and it's a very small pared down menu, you know, okay, I know that whatever these things are, like, they've got to be good because it's all, this is all they got.
That's a great analogy.
I think the same thing applies for business and stuff like that. But you know, you talk a lot about your personal brand and the Scott McKenna brand and things like that. And I know that your YouTube channel is a really big part of that. And I think that your YouTube journey has been a very interesting one because my understanding of it, correct me if I'm wrong, is that you kind of started it as a way of just sort of documenting your journey into this business. And it kind of was just like a video, like, quote unquote, you know, diary or journal for yourself. And it's, I feel like it's kind of maybe evolved a little bit over time now because you're sitting around like 14,000 subscribers as of the recording of this podcast. So how has your sort of YouTube journey developed along the way? Do you still see it as a way of just documenting for yourself, or has your sort of intentions with it, or the way that you, when you're creating content, are you creating it still for yourself or are you creating it for your audience?
It's been tough because when I started creating videos, it was May 1st of last year is when I put my first video on that channel. And it was literally nothing but document because I knew that it would be easy for me to document. And more importantly, I don't care if anyone was watching. I just wanted to see, like, I could look back at it and be like, sweet. Then the channel grew relatively fast for the content. And to an extent, no, I'm not trying to shift that because still to an extent, I feel like I'm so early in my business that I have so much more that I want to grow in and I have so much more that I want to document. And I see the biggest value of a channel that documents so much is that 3 years from now, being able to look back, you know, I believe that I'm going to build a fairly successful company. Success is a stupid word, but I love the idea of being able to let people watch 3-4 years of that journey, because I think that's ultimately what would help them the most is watching every aspect of how it got to there. But in terms of obviously what I know, a lot of people would like to see, what they'd like to, you know, see more on the channel. Are there a lot of things I could do that would be so much more specific, like tutorials, all that kind of stuff? 100%. But I've always, in my head, I don't want to be known as a vlogger. I do not want to be known as a tutorial guy. And I do not want to be known as like a business only guy. So I'm also playing the fine line of, could I do 3 to 5 tutorials a week and get tons more views and probably more subscribers? Probably, because everyone loves tutorials. But I don't want to be pigeonholed that as soon as I post something that's non-tutorial, nobody cares about it. So I'm kind of trying to find the balance of like, I don't pre-think anything that I do on that channel. Every single day I start filming and whatever suddenly in my head as I'm going through the day is like, you know what, that could probably be valuable. I'm going to actually talk more on that topic. I don't think script anything that I write, anything I say. I wake up, I start filming. If I decide I'm going to do, like I just did a gimbal review, that was me waking up and deciding today I'm just going to do a gimbal review instead of a vlog. But that's the hardest part is like, YouTube is not for money for me. It's not for anything other than just kind of continually putting out a lot of content so that it builds a personal brand of what I do. And I've been amazed at the things people don't see. Like, I don't care about affiliate links or money from YouTube. It's the opportunities that I've gotten because of even a small subscriber base, like 15,000 people or 14,000 people. People don't realize the huge perks of personal branding, and they don't realize that that is personal branding, even though it may just seem like another boring document vlog. I become known as the guy who does a lot of videos, And my work that I get from LinkedIn and all these different places, which is a huge source for me, comes from people seeing that I constantly have videos showing up in their feed.
Yeah, and you are definitely consistent. And that's one thing that I've definitely noticed. I mean, how many videos have you uploaded since
May of last year? I think yesterday was 250.
Yeah, which is crazy. So not every single day necessarily, yeah, but like pretty close to it,
almost
which is
every day.
A lot of YouTube videos. So how do you view that in sort of like your priorities of your day? Because obviously you've got a lot of stuff going on, you know, being a parent, mm-hmm. having a business that you're running with editing and like all the different things that go into that. And then this obviously is something if you're trying to do on a consistent basis, you were doing it daily for a mm-hmm. while. And then I know you kind of like, mm-hmm. you've kind of had some changes in your schedule for that, but you know, doing it on a very consistent, regular basis, how do you sort of fit that in and how do you view it from a priorities standpoint with everything else you have going on?
My priorities are my family, number one, my business, number two, and my YouTube stuff, number three. But that doesn't mean that it's not a huge priority to me, meaning
right.
I intentionally wake up every single day at 4:54 in the morning. And I edit my vlogs from 5 to 7, or if I get to 7 before the kids wake up, that's what time I edit my YouTube videos every day. And then I film all day for the YouTube stuff, and then I edit the next morning. So I have made it a priority that at a minimum of, you know, 5 days a week from 5 a.m. to 7 a.m., I'm editing them and then I'm shooting throughout it. I've decided to sleep less to make it a priority to make it actually happen. Because when I first started, or when I went into a couple of different seasons where I would say, I'm going to vlog, or I'm going to create a video when I have a good idea, or when I have a good topic, or when I have something exciting happening. What happens is everyone says that, and then nobody ever thinks that day is worth talking about. Where when you tell yourself, right. I need to do something with it every single day, or try every single day, and you have to do something with it, it's odd how people actually start to follow along with what you're doing. It's odd that almost 15,000 people essentially are just watching me work each day.
Right. Yeah.
But yet, so the amount of emails I get from people that have found just watching that journey valuable is awesome. And that's why I think people underestimate that they're like, no matter what you're doing, you could document it if you really wanted to. And oddly enough, people probably would watch it. Like, because there's other people that are also passionate about the same thing.
Yeah, I think that you get to a point in your business where you kind of forget what you didn't uh-huh. know. So things to you that are like, oh no, that's no one wants to know about that. Everybody
exactly.
knows that. At one point, you probably didn't know it, and somebody needs to know it as well. So there's always information to be had from somebody out there. And I think that it's really easy to think that I need to be an expert. I need to have this level of status or this level of whatever before I can start teaching things to people. But that's not necessarily true. There's always things people can learn. You always have things to teach people. There's always people who aren't quite where you mm-hmm. are yet, and there's always people who are above yep. you. So figuring out, you know, where you having an accurate perception of where you are in that sort of spectrum of life, and you know, being realistic about that. But at the same time, you know, like you said, you approach it from a very humble standpoint of like, hey, I'm just here to share
right.
what I know. I'm not saying I'm an expert. I'm just here to put it out, and if it's helpful to you, then great. And if not, then you don't have to watch it. This
and
is
I
mostly
think
for me,
that
you know?
That's huge, because that's a fantastic point of like, I think too many people don't do YouTube videos or don't do the type of content that I'm doing because they feel like, well, what do I really know? Well, if you've been doing mm-hmm. it for a year, you know 1 year worth more. You know 1 year more than somebody that hasn't been doing it for a year. If you've been doing it for five right. years, you know more than – it's not about – but you have to – and that's why I try so hard to position it that way, that like I'm going to share everything that I'm going through. If you see a review that's like, here's what I shoot frame rate-wise and here's how I balance, and it's not – dead accurate, I'm not telling you this is how you have to do it. I'm saying, here's how I do it. If it's valuable when you do it, sweet. But like, that's the big thing for me, is just trying to make sure that people realize I'm just taking you through the journey. And it's awesome to see how many people have found value in it, but I'm not claiming to be an expert. Like, I'm just along for the ride. But you do have to make it a priority. If you want to post a lot of YouTube videos, you do have to make it. And I just always try to tell people, do not look at the people that would say like, oh, well, YouTube changed a thing and it takes 1,000 subscribers before you can want. And I'm like, dude, you're not going to make any money from YouTube
right.
anyway.
Nothing significant.
If that's why you're going into YouTube, you've already lost. There
right.
are so many pros that come from even the small base that I've built that are from a business 4LC Studios standpoint that people just don't even understand. And that's why I think it's valuable to do it.
And I think that's definitely true. And I think that YouTube is obviously huge. And another thing that's huge this year in 2018, I'm calling it the year of the podcast, mm-hmm. because it seems like everybody and their mom literally is starting a podcast. So I know, so your YouTube video, your style is very like more conversational. You said you don't do a lot of like fancy editing mm-hmm. or, you know, any things like that. And you have, you know, obviously some edits here and there, but for the most part, it's pretty straightforward. A lot of talking mm-hmm. to the camera, just kind of sharing your thoughts and things like that. So what kind of compelled you or led you to wanting to start a podcast, which, you know, obviously is a little bit more longer form content than a, you know, more like standard short YouTube mm-hmm. video. But since you already have, you do a lot of speaking and talking and kind of just like sharing in your mm-hmm. YouTube channel, what kind of led you to wanting to have a podcast on top of that? You're already insane sounding workload.
To me, it was long form content was a no brainer that I loved the idea that I could have post an hour long piece of content and people could absorb it. And more importantly, like, mm-hmm. you know, everyone getting into podcasting, it's because people can listen to it anywhere. That's why I create podcasts. And then I think the biggest thing is also this kind of stuff. Like the people that I can get on a podcast to talk is so much easier than asking them to be on a YouTube video where I have to get them in person and ask for their time and ask for the right situation and location. It's easy to get people to give you 30 minutes, 45 minutes, an hour of time to just talk. And yet the value that people get of me being able to have certain guests or certain people is so much more than I could bring. Because if I want to talk about what makes a husband and wife filming duo unique, and I bring somebody on like you or somebody else that does that, that's more valuable. And so it also right. allows me to, I think, expand my range of topics that I know are valuable, but I'm not going to speak in them because that's not my experience. Like I had Jesse Driftwood on, who is an Instagram story machine. That's his bread and butter. Like I want him to talk about that kind of stuff. And so that's why I did it. I mean, how about you? Like you went into it obviously too. I mean, I think it's so fun. I love your idea too, because it's not just filmmaking. Like literally you do exactly what I kind of also think is such a great thing with podcasting. You have random guests that have nothing to do with the topic. Like I wanted to go to Price is Right right after I heard that guy talking about it. But I think that's a great idea. But like, I assume that a lot of your thought was somewhat similar to mine and some of these things too.
Yeah, for sure. So a lot of it, like you said, is longer form content, being able to share. Because I'd sit down and make a YouTube video about whatever, and I felt like I would, you know, talk and be like, all right, I got to cut this down. So the ability to just like, okay, I just want to talk about this for a while and kind of just share my thoughts and share my knowledge. And for me, a lot of it was being a creative outlet into something that wasn't filmmaking related and wasn't education related. Because I kind of started feeling bogged down, either like always editing wedding films, always editing sort of like wedding film tutorials or YouTube stuff that's wedding film related or whatever. So I just wanted kind of a different outlet. And I have a lot of different passions, a lot of things that I'm interested in, mostly kind of revolving around tech. And I spend a lot of time watching YouTube videos and just kind of like learning about these things. But I never really had an outlet for any way of sort of sharing mm-hmm. those things or just talking with people. And then the thing that I sort of found after I kind of started doing it was what you said, having the guests on and just having different people and being able to have these conversations with people. Because I think it's so rare in like the society that you live in today to sit down with somebody for an hour and have a very intentional one-on-one mm-hmm. conversation with no distractions, with nothing else going on, just being able to talk about things that we're passionate about, whatever that may be. And yeah, my podcast definitely, as it sort of evolved and I've kind of brought different people on, I've found that it's kind of random in the guests that are on there. None of them really necessarily correlate with each other, except that they have this sort of like underlying thread of technology sort of running right. through it, which I kind of intentionally chose that because everybody interacts with technology, no matter who you are, what you do, where you are in life, you interact with technology, or if you don't, that's interesting because there's probably yeah. a reason for that, right? Yeah. There's just technology sort of impacts everybody's life mm-hmm. no matter who you are. So just having that as a very loose central thread that kind of runs through all these different conversations has just been a lot of fun for me. And like I said at the very beginning of this podcast, you know, the technology side of this and just jumping into this and figuring out all the gear and the systems mm-hmm. and the best way to do it. Like that was a fun journey for me. But yeah, it's been good. And it's one of those things where it's kind of hard because I don't know necessarily what the like ROI of the podcast is, like other than, you know, it's building my right. personal brand. People are probably learning more about me and it's, you know, it's a way of connecting in a kind of a deeper level. But from a business standpoint, it doesn't necessarily I don't know. It may not be adding as much as other things would do, but from a sanity standpoint and just like an enjoyment of like life and, you know, deepening relationships and building new relationships, it's been really great for that. So I've really enjoyed it.
That is where, to me, the ROI of a podcast is. The ROI of a podcast to me is not that people hear my podcast and hire me for video work, but the relationships that I have built with some of the guests that I have had on that are at a much bigger level than I am in certain aspects. You never know where those relationships can go. And the conversation that I have with an hour of somebody that is at a very high level of something, that I wouldn't be able to have that conversation with them after the, like, outside of a podcast. You never know where that goes. When you're a person that is likable, that can hold a conversation, and that really important guest gets off the phone, they're like, Ty was a pretty cool guy. And then the next time you're in town, you can shoot a text and say, hey, we want to grab coffee. And he's like, yeah, Ty was a good guy. And then the next time you're in town and he's in town, and then suddenly he's looking for a person to help shoot, and he knows that Ty shoots weddings, and this person I know, that's the ROI to me of podcasts.
Right. No, for sure. Yeah, it's hard because it's hard to measure that. Yes. Right? It's hard to, like, there's no necessarily like immediate return, or you don't see necessarily like the dollar sign just like turn around or whatever. Yep. But I think, like I said, it's kind of like a long-term play. And like I said, for me, since a lot of it comes from just the enjoyment of it and the process of it and the creation of it, everything else is just a bonus, right? Like, yep, everything else on top of that is just icing on the cake. It's just, you know, anything sort of extra. And you're right. A lot of times I'll hop off of these, we'll stop recording, and I end up sitting there with the person and talking for another 30, 40 minutes sometimes, yep, just because it's like, man, like, that was a really great conversation. And for me, like, it's, like you said, I'm just really curious a lot of times. Like, yeah, I just love asking people questions and hearing about their life. And I'm always just super curious as how things work. And I've got a million different questions for everybody about anything,
and you wouldn't necessarily be able to shoot them an email and say, hey, do you have an hour to chat?
Right, exactly. Like, without having a good reason, and then the ability to share it with other people, yep, is invaluable. So,
and I think it's the same with YouTube. Like, it's the same that if you just straight up start posting videos on YouTube and look at the dollar signs coming in from it, you're gonna quit. And that's why a lot of people quit. If you go into podcasting or YouTubing trying to make that your living, you will fail. It doesn't mean that you cannot. There are tons of people that do that, but the people that do that are extremely, extremely talented storytellers, tech people, whatever they are. And you just have to decide too if that's something that you can maintain. The scariest thing to me about people who do YouTube full time is like, what happened? You know, when you're a guy like Roman Atwood, who is a humongous, humongous vlogger, and he's in his 40s now, and you could tell that now he's switching a little bit to not really doing as many vlogs. Like, if you've built your reputation on being a vlogger and then you stop vlogging and you've been doing that for 20 years, like, now what? Like, what? So it scares me when people make YouTube their living. Like, if I could start making $1 million a year from YouTube, that'd be amazing, but it still wouldn't be my main job. Because just too risky. YouTube's not out to make you money.
The adpocalypse and like all the stuff going on with YouTube, right? YouTube can change anything on a dime. Yes. You don't own anything in that. You don't own your channel. YouTube owns your channel. And if that's your only revenue stream, it can be really scary.
Yeah, so if you're relying on them and hoping that they don't change to, it's not trying to favor you. They're trying to favor their ad buyers.
Oh, yeah. They're just in it to make money, right? And they're using you. And obviously, it's great. There's plenty of people out there who make a ton of money off YouTube, and it's a great way of making a living. But I think that also, as consumers of content, we're a lot more savvy to people who are in it just for the money. And I think you can definitely tell that. And there's, you know, there's some ways to be strategic about it or whatever, but that's a really interesting shift. We could do a whole podcast on that, because seeing people like Will Smith and The Rock and all these different people who are making YouTube channels and growing their influence on YouTube and stuff like that, something's happening there. And I think that the world is definitely moving in that direction. But at the same time, you know, YouTube is also just, if you look at the trending page on YouTube, it's like Ellen DeGeneres and James, you know, the late night shows and all those types of things. They're just repurposing content from TV and giving them all the ad bucks, right? And then it's like, well, is that fair? Like, whatever, you know, is that, you know, a lot of YouTubers don't like that because, you know, they're already getting their money from TV and commercial stuff. Like, now they're getting YouTube money. They're getting all the YouTube money too. You know, it's an interesting world. It really is. But yeah, I think from a branding standpoint, and like you said, just putting out content, because I did the same sort of thing. I started with YouTube just because I like making tutorials. I like talking about certain things and sharing it.
Yeah, and you do.
And one of my videos kind of blew up, like, quote unquote blew up. And then I was like, oh, and then you kind of just like want to keep going and you want to keep sharing and helping people out and seeing the comments. People are like, oh my gosh, this is so helpful. Thank you so much.
Yep.
You're like, that kind of fuels you to want to keep going and creating more content.
Yeah, that's literally what fuels me. What fuels me are the emails I get every day from different people or different things that are like, I've been doing video for a while and this has really helped me. I started doing this and I've done some one-on-one consulting now with people and hearing the impact. I just love the impact it makes on people more than anything. And yeah, that's what fuels me. The views don't fuel me as much as the person that writes in that's like, you know, we chatted for a while back or this helped me so much and I just did this and now it's working and I'm so thankful. Like that's fueling. I love knowing that it just impacts people.
Yeah.
It's super cool. Great.
On your YouTube channel, you do talk a lot about technology and you love tech stuff.
Technology.
And Scott is probably one of the few people in the world who owns more Apple products than I do. And that is saying something. So I just want to talk to you about a couple of different things. I guess we'll start with Apple because that just seems like an easy one. As somebody who is, you know, a quote unquote Apple fanboy, what is your sort of thoughts on the status of Apple right now? I feel like people are kind of down on Apple right now as far as professionals, like creative professionals, kind of, you know, Apple seems to kind of be leaving us in the dust or kind of forgetting us. What are your thoughts on that? Do you have any sort of thoughts on this, the current status of Apple as a brand?
I think that Apple as a brand has shifted in my head a lot to over in terms of how I view them over the last couple of years. I think that they know where they're getting all their money from, and it is not professionals. They know that consumers are where they're making all their money. They know that the reason that they made that Mac Pro and didn't do everything everyone really wanted is because ultimately they knew that only a certain amount of people actually will buy the Mac Pro, but everyone will buy the cheapest iPad, the cheapest MacBook, they're just, whether you like it or not as a professional in the fields, I don't think that that's who they're really trying to go after. I think they make great products, so a lot of professionals use them. I think the iPhone, the iPad are the greatest things that they create. I have not been thrilled with my highest-end 15-inch MacBook Pro that I have at all. It has been the most disappointing product. I still love Apple to death, and I still get, from a business standpoint, they make more money from people that aren't me than anything. That's just right. That's business. Like, do you agree?
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, from a strategy standpoint, like, it totally makes sense. But then also, I mean, you're the type of person who you're bought into the ecosystem. And didn't you try and switch off the iPhone?
Yes. I didn't necessarily try to switch off, but I did buy a Note 8 to have it as a business line. And then I couldn't do both simultaneously. But yes, I'm sucked into that ecosystem.
Right, which is a perfect example of being in the ecosystem and having been in it for a long time. It's really hard to switch. They know all that. Like, they've got it figured out. And there's a reason they're one of the richest companies in the world.
Yes.
Right? And they have more money as a company than like half of the countries in the world. But yeah, it's hard because I'm still running, like, you know, I have a 2014 iMac and a 2013 MacBook Pro. So like, I'm still kind of like on a little bit older hardware as far as that stuff goes. From a consumer standpoint, from someone who uses an iPhone and an iPad and an Apple Watch and AirPods and all that sort of stuff, I love it, right? I mean, there's
seamless.
A few things where you kind of see, and people can give them a hard time from like not being as innovative as before. But I think that when you're the most innovative company leading the industry and literally just like the tech industry in general, it's hard to maintain that for 20 years straight. You know what I mean? There's a certain point where you kind of are going to stall and maybe plateau as far as like pushing the line of innovation and stuff like that. But as far as like usability on a daily basis, it's still, you know, bar none, I think, the best experience that you can have.
Yes, I think that's great. Usability, the way things work, the power of how good they work when they work, Apple, I think, dominates that. Everything they do is done so well. I do not see them as the big innovator anymore at all. I see them as the people that do the innovation someone else creates the best. But I think that ever since Steve Jobs stepped down, I think they lost a big part of their innovation. Now, like you said, part of it that it's hard to keep up. Everyone's doing things so well, it's hard to keep up. But I don't necessarily see them as the innovator at all. I think that, you know, they just released the HomePod, and I think it's not even close to as good as the Alexas and all those different things. She's now going to start listening to me right at my desk. I think that they are really good at understanding, like, making things really well when they do it. Like, the HomePod sounds phenomenal, better than any speaker you can buy. It's also the most expensive, and it's also the dumbest smart speaker. So
right.
I think that I don't see them as an innovator, but I think that they, when they eventually nail it, they do it really well. That's how they keep winning.
And I think that they are very much they have a very solid understanding of their ecosystem and the power of their ecosystem, right? They understand that even if their smart speaker isn't as smart as some of the other ones, they know that just because it has Siri and because it integrates with Apple Music and because it's going to integrate better with your AirPlay and your Apple TV and your watch and all those other things, there's a certain percentage of people out there, a big dollar sign worth of people out there who will still buy it and who will be able to make it so that they make money, right? And I feel like they don't care as much about the critics as they do about their investors and about the dollar signs, which, again, you kind of have to think that way to a certain extent. But because an Amazon is kind of the opposite. Like Amazon, I don't even know if Amazon's profitable. I mean, they're like kind of always been teetering on the level of like actually making a profit versus how much they spend and like all those types of things. But, you know, it's just hard because, like you said, the AirPod is so beautiful, or the HomePod rather. The HomePod is so beautiful and it like, sounds so good. But Siri, I mean, Siri is, I gotta think, is like one of the most mind-boggling things in that Apple has ever done, because it's like, I don't know why it's still so bad. Like, it doesn't make any sense. They have all the money in the world to invest.
I don't get it either.
I just have no, it doesn't make any sense. And they had a head start on everybody, which isn't naturally Apple's kind of like MO. They're normally kind of, like I said, wait until the end and then perfect something. I just can't figure out why Siri has been so difficult for them to figure out.
I don't know either, especially when it comes, yeah, some of the stuff that, like, when I had the Note 8 for a little bit and I was using their built-in voice thing or whatever, and the things that I could ask it and that it would do and that it would just naturally do so well, and I'm like, why doesn't my iPhone do that? Like, why can't my iPhone? Like, I don't understand either. It's not that they don't have money. It's not that they don't realize the power of it. I don't know. I wonder if they just are not really realizing that voice is taking over and that they really should be trying hard to make it good, because I am so obsessed with my Amazon Echoes that are on every floor of my house. The amount of times that I use them, and I'm like, wow, I don't realize how much voice is actually changing everything I do. It's unbelievable. So yeah, I don't know what the heck they're doing. I don't get it.
You've got to be a reason. Like, I've heard different theories as if, you know, maybe it was built on a poor infrastructure, and now they're at a point now where the only way they can fix it or to like make it significantly better is to like tear the whole thing down and start over, which I'm like, you've got like $250 billion in the bank. Like, let's make it happen.
They're the first like $1 trillion company. That. Like, yeah,
right. And it's going
to
be
any money
like,
you can to fix it.
It's the only thing that people have to really hold against Apple. I mean, there's certain things that Apple has done like that have kind of fallen to the wayside, like iCloud and like those types of things. Sometimes they're like, meh, like a little kind of weird. And they have a few software things that are just kind of not as perfect as they used to be. And they could probably tighten up and do better. But the biggest knock anybody has on Apple is just Siri. And if they could just, I don't know why they can't just invest like a ton of money into Siri, make it half as good as the Alexa, or make it as good. You know, Amazon came at this thing. It's one of the 80 things that they do, right? It's not even their specialty, and they're crushing Apple at it. This is literally one of the like five things that you need to do well. Put some money into it, put some people behind it, and let's make this thing happen.
Yeah, I don't really know. I mean, it's, yeah, they're, the voice recognition from Siri is just so awful. The fact that they can't, the fact that I could say it in the most clear robotic voice possibly, and there's sometimes it puts things in and they're like, why would you even think that I said that? Or like, why aren't you analyzing what I said as a whole and automatically putting a question mark? Why are you not, like, you can, it's smart enough to do that stuff. Like, it, so I don't really know. But ultimately, yes, I'm still a huge Apple fan, still so tied into the ecosystem that clearly, as much as I want to critique them, I still buy their products. So they're doing things well. They're well aware that they're doing things well. But it is annoying to me when I see companies that have a crazy amount of money that could make something good. Like, can I just know? Like, I worked for Apple for a while, so I also know that they don't tell you anything even as an employee. But I just wish I could be like, what? Why is it not good yet? Like, I just, I don't get it.
Right. But then they do something like, come up with something like the AirPods, right?
Yeah,
which is kind of a sleeper product
ever.
That nobody even ever really asked for. Nobody was really wanting. But they come out with this AirPod thing. But people kind of laughed at it first. But then it turns out to be like one of the best products that they make, right?
The best.
The AirPods is one of my favorite objects in my life that I use every single day that literally has like changed the way that I live my life. And this is like, okay, this is what I expect from Apple, right? This is what I want. AirPods aren't perfect, and I'm sure version 2 will come out at some point and they'll be even better. But, you know, it's one of those things where it's like literally nothing can touch it. Nobody can get close to it from any other, you know, Bose,
yes, from
any of the other big AirPod
point. Yep.
Nobody can get even close to touching it. And you're like, okay, if you can do this for something we don't even really want, nobody really wanted that, right? We're glad that we have it. We didn't ask for it.
And I think maybe one of the, because like you look at the AirPods, for example, and I think that maybe they look at things from a standpoint of, okay, let's look at Bluetooth headphones as a whole. What are the things that drive people crazy about Bluetooth? Okay, they don't like having to hold down a button to turn it on. Okay, let's eliminate that. You put it in your ear, it turns on. They don't like having to find a case to store them in. Okay, well, let's make a case that also charges it. Okay, they also like being able to switch in between devices. You got to make that easy in our ecosystem. Maybe,
right.
Maybe, let's hope, they're really delaying Siri to look at all the people doing these voice things and saying, what are they failing at? And let's change it so that when Siri 2 comes out, they say, finally, this is what it's supposed to be. But
what are they waiting for? You know, like you said, you've got Alexas in every area of your house. Yes. We have an Alexa and a Google Home, right? Which both work way better than Siri ever does. So, I mean, I hope that's what it is. I hope that they come out with Siri 2 or at some point, or there's some crazy thing that they're working on in the background, and they come out with it, and we all are blown away, and it solves all of our Siri problems.
Yeah, I don't know. But it's, I definitely think that I love the fact that technology is just getting so good and that everybody is having to be on their toes, keeping up with camera gear and all this stuff. The amount of good gear that's coming out all the time just makes me excited, because I know that ultimately that just leads to everything getting cheaper because you have to compete. Like, I love the fact that the camera that I own and that I have three of and that I think are phenomenal cameras are so inexpensive. Like, that's awesome. Like, that's just great to me. The fact that when someone makes something unbelievably well and then it's affordable, everybody else has to do it too. And that's great as a consumer.
Yeah. And that's something that I'm sure that your wife probably laments, because I know that you are, you're pretty big into buying gear. Yeah. You're very experimental in your purchases. And I know you do a lot of like buying and returning, and you've kind of experimented with a bunch of different camera brands. Yeah. And I'm sure it's not just camera brands. I'm sure you kind of do with everything in your life. Mm-hmm. Talk to me a little about that. Do you have a process for that? Do you have like a research process? Is your research just like, I'm going to buy this thing because it looks good and figure it out and then take a hit on it? Like, do you have a...
My process, I try, as much as it seems like I buy a lot of stuff. I mean, I do buy a lot of stuff. Don't think I don't buy a lot of stuff. But I don't buy something to say, let's just buy it because it looks fun. Every camera I've ever bought, the switches I went with the GH5, the idea of buying new things specifically for a gimbal camera, I look and decide to buy things based on me saying, what issues am I having with what I am using? And is there a solution that would fix this? If I look at it. So when I was using all the Sonys, I was running into an issue of not having unlimited recording time, terrible battery life, and unreliable when it comes to overheating. So I knew that those were not options for me. So what did I do? I said, the GH5 gets me the image quality I want, no overheating, unlimited recording time, and very good battery life. So it made sense to me that I could find a solution that worked. And I did the same thing with when I was buying a gimbal. Well, I mean, when I was buying a camera specifically for the gimbal, and I'm still kind of in the midst of that. What are the things I need for that? Then I try to find a solution that works for that. But a lot of it shifts based on what type of work you're doing. So like a lot of the shift that I've gone into the GH5's different things are not just for weddings. That's the biggest shift for me, is the fact that I used to, if I shot weddings and only weddings ever, I probably wouldn't have the GH5's as my main camera. I probably would do something again from Canon or the C series line or something, because I like them ergonomically. I just look at it from a whole of what do I like to do other than weddings, and what is the best overall camera? And the answer is there's not. So it's kind of trying to figure out. I only buy gear when I feel like something has solved the solution. Let me buy it and see if it actually has, or if just on paper, if it seems like it has.
Right, because there's always pros and cons, right? Because obviously switching from the Sony line to the GH5, so you got all those pros you mentioned, but you got it struggles more in low light. It has a smaller sensor. There's a few things you have to work around. Like, so yeah, obviously there's no perfect camera that's out there. Did you go straight into Sony when you started your business, or were you on Canon?
We started all on 5D Mark IIs, then Mark IIIs, and then we switched from the Mark IIIs to the Sonys because of low light. And not even that the Mark III was bad on low light at all, just more of I really liked what Sony was doing. I liked the 4K. That was a huge thing for me. So like, we switched to all that, used that for a year, then started to get really annoyed that I was doing weddings in the summer and the camera wouldn't record the whole time. It would overheat. That's not an option in weddings. Like, that's yeah. Sorry, that does not work.
That's pretty important. There, yeah, for sure. Yeah.
How about you? I mean, do you like, what's your process when you buy something?
Yeah, so I think I'm very loyal when it comes to things, and I really don't like change, just more as a personality trait. So the fact that I've been on Canon for so long and I really like Canon stuff, I don't know, something in my brain, I just don't even want to like think about switching off of that. Mm-hmm. And the same thing with Apple stuff. Like, even when there's like a lot of like glaring things with Apple that aren't perfect,
right?
I just have like a really hard time mentally like switching off of that. I don't know what it is. And it's in a lot of other like areas and facets of my life, which I'm sure would be somewhat interesting to do some sort of like a psychoanalysis on why I am the way that I am when it comes to that sort of thing. But I'm kind of under the notion, if it's not broke, don't fix it.
Canon is very reliable. Like,
right. So I have never had any really giant reason to jump off onto something else. And I'm also a very logical thinker. So whenever it comes to purchasing gear and things like that, I always try and do a ton of research and do as much research as I possibly can. But at the end of the day, a lot of it kind of comes down to just like a gut feeling thing. Like, okay, like, is this going to make my thing like things better or worse? Is this a good price? Is it going to improve my films and things like that? And honestly, we went for a really long time where we didn't buy any gear. Like, I bought the C100 Mark I in 2014, I think, you know, which was, you know, or maybe 2015. So, you know, 3 or 4 years after it had come out, and I got it, you know, for a really good price. And we had just that in our 5D Mark III and our 6D for a really long time.
Right.
And, you know, that was kind of all we had. But my other big thing I try and always do is invest heavily up front, like invest in quality things up front. I don't like to skimp out. I don't like to go for like the cheap option.
I agree.
Because it'll last me forever. You know, I bought my Canon 50mm 1.2 when I was in college, and I spent, you know, at the time, probably like $1,500 on it, which for a college kid was like a huge chunk of money. But here I am, you know, 6 years later or whatever, and I'm still using that on every single shoot, every single wedding, every single thing that I've done. And I could probably turn around and sell it if I wanted to, you know, for $1,000, $1,200, and, you know, it retained a lot of its value. So that's a lot of it for me. How well is it going to retain value? How much is it going to actually impact our films? And I try not to get too caught up in trends and things like that. We're currently in the process of, you know, we have this gimbal camera. We have the A6300 on the gimbal. And there are some downsides to it, right? There's some things I'm looking at that are like, I can work around them and I can make it work. But, you know, I want to shoot, we've been shooting more slow motion as our style has sort of evolved.
Right.
And I want to be able to shoot, you know, good slow motion, and it does shoot, you know, 1080p 60 frames per second, but it's not nearly as sharp as it is in 4K, and it's, you know, that's like the biggest limitation. I just don't love the way that it looks, and it looks fine, and you watch a lot of our films and they look, you can't really tell, you know, the brides can't tell or whatever. But as the more I'm realizing, okay, I've been using the gimbal camera for more and more percentage of the shots that end up in the film, maybe I should look into another type of solution, you know. And then at that point, then it becomes, okay, researching and figuring out, okay, what's out there, what are my options, how much is it going to cost, looking to the future. And
I think that's a great way to look at it. You're looking at it and saying, you want to shoot a higher frame rate, you want to shoot more, since you're shooting more of that, you're trying to solve a problem rather than trying to solve a problem to something that you're now doing more of, where, yes, if you just say to yourself, I want to buy the brand new Sony because it's got to be the best, it's the newest, like, that's a bad reason.
Right.
The idea of trying to solve a problem, and so the reason you haven't switched from Canon is because, like, if you take out 4K as being a primary need, the Canons are insanely reliable, they have great color, and they have great autofocus if you use their system, and that's important to, you know, you if you are a person that does that kind of stuff. Like,
and I don't use autofocus. Exactly. Like, I've gone so long. I think I'm going to become like an old curmudgeonly man who's like stuck in my ways, because like, I can already see that happening. I'm not very old, but I can already see myself kind of being like stuck in my ways. I'm like, I don't need autofocus. You know, I'm like, I don't need autofocus. Like, I use manual most of the time. And even on my C100 Mark II that has, you know, autofocus, I don't really use it. Like, I've never actually, it's not that usable on the way that it's set up. I use the autofocus on the A6300, I guess. But yeah, I need to have a really good reason to do something.
And that's a good thing.
And it has
thing.
To make like a significant impact where people can tell,
yes,
can tell the difference. And I'm sure someday we'll have to upgrade to 4K. And I'm sure that someday, you know, that's going to become the industry standard and whatever. But that's definitely not the case right now. My kind of like long-term plan is like the C200 is the camera that I really want, but I just can't justify buying it. It's just so expensive at this point right now for what it's offering. And it's kind of big for weddings. Like, there's a, you know, as much as I'd love to have that, my goal would be kind of wait, like kind of like I did with the C100s, wait 3 years or whatever until it comes down to around like the $3,000 price range, and then buy one, and then add it into my lineup, and then kind of start slowly adding in more 4K or more whatever. I think another thing that people don't think about when they're purchasing cameras and things like that is your computer and your the the workflow on the back end.
Yeah.
Because the reason I love the C100 so much, I mean, there's a million reasons why, but one of the reasons I love them so much is because it's really small file sizes,
right?
And they're really easy to work with. They're very easy on my computer. I don't have a very fast computer relatively, you know, and I can edit on them all day long. It's just a really great option for me because I'm only shooting between 100 and maybe like 120 gigs of total media per wedding.
Wow, that's small. I would,
you know,
I wish,
which
I
is so small, you know. So what, for shooting on the GH5s, you're shooting in 4K all day long, I'm assuming. Yep. What is your normal, like, what do you bring home from a normal wedding?
I would say a small wedding where I felt like I really didn't get that much footage would be about 280 gigs, 250 gigs would be like small. I would say a wedding where I really got a chance to shoot even more than I like usually shoot, it can be 450 gigs, 500 gigs, which at this point I don't care about. But yes, that's a big factor.
Yeah, and that starts adding up. I mean, hard drive space, hard drives aren't free, you know, I mean, they're getting cheaper, but they're not free, you know, so it's just all those different factors that kind of go into it. So, but once I'm ready to buy something, like once I've made up my mind that I'm going to buy it, I'm pretty quick to like pull the trigger on it, you know, and I'm very ready. Okay, like I bought the Crane 2. Like I've been thinking about it for a long time and I kind of tried to think about it too much because it can kind of consume my thoughts. But as soon as I was like, you know what? I'm going to do it. Like it like clicked in my mind like, okay, yes. Like I got the kind of green light in my logical brain of like checking all the boxes. It was like immediately like got to go order it off Amazon, you know? And it feels kind of like an impulse buy at that point, but it really wasn't because I've done so much research on it. I've been thinking about it for months. But I just picked that up and I've been putting my C100 on that, which has been really interesting.
Yeah, it's a pretty heavy, like one-handed machine.
A big shift, from the A6300 up to the C100. Yeah.
No, and I think, and you're looking at it in a much better way than I do. And most times, I'm one of those people, like, if I think that it can solve an issue, I'm just going to buy it and try it. And if it sucks, I'm not a person that buys things to essentially rent it to return it. I return it if it doesn't solve what I thought it was going to solve. But I think that too many times it's hard to know if it solves my solution by watching YouTube videos. I have to try it. So I think it's a better option to do what you do, which is actually really analyze it. If it doesn't make you more money or really solve a problem or actually make a difference in terms of quality, it's not worth it. And too many people just need to buy it because it's the newest thing every year. And then you're just not making any money with your company. Like,
oh yeah. And I never, ever return things ever. Unless there's like a defect or something is wrong. If I purchase something, it's because I know it's what I want and I'm going to keep it forever. Even if it's not really that, I'll like make it in my mind. I'll make it so that it's fine. You know, I'm like, it's fine. This is exactly what I wanted, even if it really wasn't, just because I really don't like returning things. And I also hate selling gear because I'm always like, well, someday we might need this. You know, there might be a scenario where I'm going to need this lens or whatever.
See, that's where we're opposite too, though. Like, I don't mind returning. And I don't mind returning things simply because I usually buy them all from the same retailer. So I don't mind if I have to ship something back and you eat a little bit of cost because I'm going to buy something else in exchange for it.
Right. Yeah. And I probably should be better at that, honestly. But yeah, I mean, like I said, and the thing too is, investing early from the beginning has made that a lot easier for me. You know,
You got good gear at the beginning that has lasted and it's been reliable. And if it's not broken, keep it.
And I think that one of the most frustrating things for me is being in these Facebook groups and getting in these conversations where everyone's kind of arguing over like, this is the best way to do it. Like, and if people kind of come in with the mindset of like, if you're not using this camera, then you're an idiot. Yeah. You know, and those kinds of conversations always make me mad because, I mean, it usually happens around like the GH5 C100 debate, right? Which shouldn't even be a debate because they're in such like different stratospheres of like types of cameras and what they offer and priorities if you're using them. But I think the GH5 is a great camera that has some downsides, but it has a lot of pros and a lot of upsides, and it's a fantastic camera. Same with the C100. I think the C100 has a lot of pros that are different than the pros of the GH5, but also has a lot of cons that, you know, the GH5 might be able to do, but that doesn't mean that the GH5 is better or the C100 is better. It just means that they're different.
Yep.
They have different reasons you should use them. They're made for different people, for different situations and things like that. So it all comes down to your personal preference and like what you enjoy and whatever. And also financially, if you have the financial freedom and you can make it work where you can be buying things and experimenting and returning and taking a little bit of a loss and whatever, then that's great. But if you don't have the freedom to do that, I think that people can get a lot more out of their cameras and a lot more out of their gear before upgrading, before moving on to something else than they even realize.
Yeah, just something as simple as like if you had a camera that you're like, oh, this camera, the only thing it's not good at is low light. Well, get good lighting. And your camera probably will look a lot better. Like, that's the other thing is people kind of sometimes just get lazy and they think that they need to have the camera that does everything so that they don't have to actually do any work to make it look good. Like, if you still had the if you still had the 5D Mark II, you would still get just as many weddings as you do now. Like,
right.
Like that's just reality. It doesn't mean that in your head you would be the, it would be the same exact quality, but like that's what people don't realize. It's like you buying a red tomorrow wouldn't get you more weddings.
Right. And that's the thing we talk. So we actually just put out a business course. It's a, you know, it's basically our thoughts on business, kind of like you're talking about, like everything that we've learned through business. It's, you know, 2 days, it's 20 some odd hours of content talking about how we run our business and how we do different things. And one thing you'll never hear me talk about is part of our marketing materials or the way that we promote ourselves or anything like that is based off the quality of our work, right? We believe that we make great films. We try and make the best films we possibly can, but we're not marketing ourselves based off of that. Yep. All of our marketing and everything we do is solely based off of the experience that we provide, who we are as people, and how we can make people feel. Because honestly, that is going to be the biggest differentiator. If you make somebody an amazing film and it's the most beautiful, award-winning looking film, but they feel awful or they don't feel like they were valued or they had a really bad experience, they're never going to refer you. They're never going to come back 100%. To you. And it's really hard to grow your business. And I think people think that if I have better quality films, if I shoot in 4K, if my films just looked a little bit better, well, then I'll get all the bookings and then I'll be able to raise my prices and then, you know, everything will just come. And that's not true at all. And if there's one thing we've learned over the 5 years of business, it's that the strategy behind business and the way that we run our business and the experience, the client experience we can offer people is bar none, way more valuable, way has a much bigger impact on people booking us or not booking us than if we're shooting in 4K or not shooting in 4K or whatever.
And it will forever. And I think that right now is an even better time to truly understand that, because here's the honest truth. Your iPhone shoots really good video now. Like the gear is getting better and better and better and being even better in an automatic mode that someone can pick it up and start to shoot, that if you do not realize that your ultimate sale comes from experience and you as a person, you're in trouble, because the gear is just good now and it's going to get better and better. Everyone's films are looking more and more and more similar in terms of actual quality, but it doesn't mean that everyone's doing the same amount of work. So I think that that's a fantastic point and everyone needs to understand that. If you focus on just having the best looking films and that's it, you won't succeed.
Right. And I think there's obviously a baseline of quality. Like, I'm not saying like you shouldn't care about the quality of your films. Like if you've got really awful films and you have a lot of technical problems and you know, whatever, yes, you're going to have a hard time being successful and raising prices and things like that. But I think there's a baseline standard that if you can get, you know, the baseline gear to get you to that certain point, which at this point would be, you know, a whatever, what does the A6300 cost these days?
Yeah,
you know,
$600.
$700, yeah. $600, you know? So you get a couple $600 cameras, invest in some nicer glass, pick up an audio recorder or two, know how to use a monopod well, and learn some good editing techniques. Right? If you can kind of master that base, you can kind of start from there and then grow. Now, obviously, like adding drones and sliders and gimbals and like all those things, like they make a difference in that, you know, that's some of the stuff people want. But even that stuff is becoming more and more and more affordable. Yep. And I think that so many people, yeah, like, fall into that trap. And if you fall into that trap too early and you start pouring all of your money into gear thinking that's going to make a big difference and you neglect the business side of things, you're going to wind up with a lot of really nice gear and like not a lot of weddings to shoot.
You always just have to realize that your cringe line, your line of the little difference that this new camera could make means nothing to a bride and groom. Like you said, it's different if you had tons of shaky footage and if your footage looked absolutely horrible because you had a T1 eye at this point or something. It's another thing if you're like, I currently have a C100, but I really think that if I went to the C200 night and day, like, no, it's
they're gonna be knocking, they're gonna be banging down the door trying to get me to book their wedding if I buy a C200.
You're gonna see the big differences, but in your average everyday films that your bride sees, they're not saying, wow, look at that dynamic range that guy had, look at that 120 frames a second. They don't know what that
they don't have any idea. Right. And so for, like you said, like shaky footage is going to be shaky footage if you're shooting on a T1i or a red. Like that's not going to matter. You need to learn how to use your monopod. You need to learn the proper technique of holding your monopod. Like that is a simple thing. Right? So that's why I say people can make great films with any camera. It comes down to, there's some conveniences you might have to work out for. Overheating is one of those things where you're like, it's something you want to try and avoid for the most part, but there's ways you can work around it. There's things that you can do if you're aware of them. And obviously upgrading from an A6300 to an A7S III or whenever that comes out, you know, is going to be, there's some advantages that you'll have that'll make your life a little bit easier, but it's not going to make you a better filmmaker, and yep. it's not going to help you book more weddings or anything like that. Yep. So, and I know it's one of those things that's like kind of a, it's a funny caveat, because we both love talking about gear just because of our personalities, and we can talk about gear all day, and we can kind of nerd out on the specs and this and that or whatever. But especially if you're just getting started, I think it's so easy to see people like us, or, you know, other people in the industry talk about that stuff all day long, and that's all we ever talk about. But nobody ever talks about business. Nobody ever talks about how to book clients or how your website should look and all this sort of stuff. And I'm saying, like, no, don't spend $3,000 to buy that new camera. Spend $3,000 on a really good website template and go get yourself a beautiful looking website, because that's way more important than the difference in quality you're going to get from the A7S2 to the A7 III or whatever, you know?
Yep. And I think that's where we're both trying to cater a lot of our content to. Like, same. Yes, I'm a gearhead and we could talk about that all day, but ultimately at the end of the day, I think you and I both realize, and what we're trying to teach people, is that there is so much more than the best camera. And if you get that really well done, you can get a lot of work, and then your films should get better. But like, by you obviously doing more work, clearly you should try to work and get better and better at your films, but you got to get them first before you can, before you can actually even show work.
Right. And investing in education, I think, is also a very overlooked thing. I think there's a huge value to investing in education, and that doesn't have to necessarily mean money, right? Investing your time in scouring the internet for YouTube videos, watching Scott's content, watching our content, watching Wedding Film School. Like, there's all these great resources that are out there, but also investing money. Like, there's value to investing money to something like the Academy, you know, the Story and Heart Academy. Like, that's a really great resource.
Workshops.
Muse storytelling, even something like Creative Live, right?
Yep.
These little investments in education are going to make a much bigger impact on your overall success as a wedding filmmaker than that newer lens or that new gimbal or, you know, like the third slider that you've tried or whatever, right? Like, get the basics. You know, obviously you need to have some equipment. It's, you can't shoot weddings without equipment, but those are the things I think people should focus more on. And I think this is a perfect place to end, because I think that this is so great for people. So for us, if you want to come find us, we just put out this business course. If you're interested in that, you can go find that. It's on our website. It's theherrington.com. You can look in the shop and it'll under education, and it'll be there. You can find me on Instagram at Tyler Herrington. My YouTube channel, you can just search for The Herrington's on YouTube. But Scott, where can people find you if they want to find more about you?
Yeah, I mean, my favorite platforms are YouTube, Twitter, and Instagram. That's my main places. YouTube is just Scott McKenna, Instagram Scott McKenna, and Twitter, unfortunately, is Scott W. McKenna, until I get Twitter to release whoever has Scott W. So I don't know how to do that. If you have solutions, let me know. I got to talk to Craig. He got them to release Craig Adams and got that back. I got to figure out how. I got to text him and ask him how he actually got that.
But anyway, you just got to message the person. Do you know if the person who has the one you want, are they active on Twitter, or is it just kind of like a dead account?
No. For all I know, it could be me, and somehow it's just not sending me. I don't have a clue. I don't think so, though. But regardless, those are the main place to find me. And then my actual company is just 4LCstudios.com, the number 4. But I post a lot of just content on my own stuff more than anything. Sure. Thanks for having me / co-hosting. This was fun. We got to do this more often and talk and get into this for sure. So thanks to Tyler for being on the podcast. Hope you found this episode valuable, even though it was a little long. Lots of stuff we covered here. And as always, connect with me on Twitter at Scott W. McKenna. Let me know what you thought. Let me know some takeaways. Let me know some things that made you think a little bit harder than something else. And as always, let me know who you'd like to hear next on the podcast, or what topics you'd like to hear discussed. I love knowing what will help you guys even more. So thanks for listening to the Scott McKenna podcast. Until next time, go create something.